Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Caroline O'Donoghue, good afternoon.
Hi, Brendan, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm always happy to hear a good Cork girl on the line. So, Caroline, you're a writer, and there's a huge buzz around your new novel, The Rachel Incident. But you're also a journalist. You're a kind of a pop culture historian, I would say. But will we start with the book, The Rachel Incident? Do you want to give people a flavour of what the book is? It's kind of a, I would say, darkly funny coming-of-age novel.
Yes, yes. No, and Brendan, it's a real thrill to talk about this book with a fellow UCC alumni, because I think it might be the first UCC campus novel. We've had a lot of Trinity novels,
yeah,
a few UCD novels, but no UCC novels. So the Rachel incident is told from the perspective of Rachel, and it begins in the present day with a kind of, she's an Irish girl, she's a Cork girl who's living in London, a lot like myself, and she's heavily pregnant, she's a journalist, and she's at a late toy show screening at around Christmas, and she's got a perfectly nice life, and suddenly someone comes up to her at this late toy show who used to be in college with her and says, have you heard anything about Dr. Byrne? And then, you know, Rachel freezes up, and the first thought that occurs to her is, how can I tell this person that I was not, despite popular rumor around Cork at the time, sleeping with Dr. Byrne? And then so that we start at the end, really. And then we go back 10 years in time to her living on Shandon Street in Cork with her best friend, James Devlin, who was in the closet, and the their relationship with this English professor, his wife, and their various loves and betrayals that happened throughout. It's a very difficult novel to speak about without getting into spoilers, but there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of betrayal.
And there is there's a tangled web, and none of it kind of obvious. And you mentioned about it being a UCC novel. It's funny, I had a memoir last week that mentioned Gorby's, but in this we have The Brogue, which people... Is The Brogue still there? I don't know.
No, it's gone now. It's gone. And it's a huge pain to me every time I see it.
So On Brogue, I think it was more properly called.
Yes.
And then a lot of action around Shandon Street, English Markets in there, UCC. It does feel like you were relishing setting it, like in what was obviously your own kind of coming of age hinterland, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was fabulous as well, because I'm sure, as you probably feel as a Cork man, that, you know, we obviously have a great deal of self-importance, famously, as Cork people, and we want everyone to see how great it is. And I actually read a review this morning that says, O'Donoghue makes Cork in the 2000s sound like the East Village in the 80s. And I was like, yeah! And, you know, I'm completely one of those cliched Irish writers where, you know, I've been living in London for 12 years, and the longer I spend away from Ireland, the more granularly I feel the need to depict it. And, you know, so this is like, if you lived in Cork in 2010, you will recognize all these places, all these people. And I hope in that specificity, a great generalness will be found as well, because I think everyone's youth kind of looked like this, no matter when they came of age. It looked like, you know, cheap pints and bad clothes and bad piercings and terrible flats and that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, you do portray that kind of student living very well. Actually, you put up a reel on your Instagram there the other day, I think kind of in conjunction with the book, showing the aesthetic of college life, the aesthetic being that, like, there really was no aesthetic then. We were a bit more, well, I'm much older than you, but it was a bit more earthy in the past, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Completely. There was a rough and readiness, a sense that you could, like, wear your tights for 4 or 5 days in a row. And, you know, like, your handbag would always be littered with, like, loose, crumbled up fags and Nurofen. You know, it was a less together time. And what's nice is that, like, when people talk to me about the book, it doesn't matter if they came of age in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s.
Yeah.
Kind of student poverty always kind of looks the same, you know?
The kids are a bit more glossy these days, I feel, are they?
They are a bit, yeah. It's a bit distracting. Like, I write for teenagers as well, and so I meet a lot of teenagers as a result. And while I'm thrilled to see that you still see the same kids with the crap hair and the sort of holes in the fingers of the jumpers and drawings all over their hands and all that scuzziness, you also do get an enormous amount of, like, of teenagers. You're like, Jesus, you could be on Italian Vogue. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit terrifying.
I think on that theme as well, there's an interesting thing in the book, right? Sex kind of permeates the book, right? which in a weird way, you wouldn't be used to that so much anymore. Because on one hand, there's kind of sexualized imagery everywhere in the culture. But the culture actually is starting to shy away from actual real kind of gritty sex, isn't it? Which you do yeah. deal with.
Oh, that's such a wonderful point. Yeah, I read a headline the other day. I thought it was brilliant, where it said, "Everyone is sexy and nobody is Randy." And I thought that actually sums up
Randy. That's such yeah.
I'm saying Randy because it's a more radio friendly word. But
yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I it's interesting, isn't it? How in the last few years that there is a highly sexual, you know, obviously everyone's got an Instagram presence and everyone wants to post the thirst traps of themselves in holidays or whatever. But almost everyone I speak to who is single and who is out there is finding the actual sexual marketplace fairly dismal, you know.
And what do you think that is?
It's such a good point. I think, I haven't been single in so long. I don't know, really.
Yes, exactly. We wouldn't know. Yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't know. Yeah. Sometimes I do wonder, and this is a pet theory of mine, and it might be a bit lazy, but I do think that it's the phones a little bit. Because, you know, in order to get in the mood to, you know, be sitting with your partner or whatever and be like, oh, you know, they're looking a bit nice or whatever. This could be a different kind of Wednesday evening. You kind of have to be bored. A little bit. You have to be slightly bored in order for your mind to wander, to naturally go there.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
So maybe the phones are doing this on a mass level.
I think you're onto something there. Like it was refreshing. There was almost, I'd say, an innocence like about the fact that, like, Rachel, your main character, she is, to use your word, kind of randy, she, in that old fashioned way.
She is. And what I loved about writing that character is that I think, you know, when we see, I think I'm a bit prudy, where, like, whenever I watch, you know, a new prestige TV show, you always yes. see a lot of full frontal and a lot of poor, young, beautiful actresses who are, you know, engaging in all sorts or whatever. And I loved writing Rachel because she's a big girl, you know, she's 6 foot. She's a grand horse of a girl, as she says herself. And, you know, we're meeting here in this year of her life where she's sort of drinking all the time. None of her clothes fit. Her hair is never cut. You know, she never washes the sheets. And she's having, you know, the best sex of her life with this dairy man she's obsessed with, who's about a foot shorter than her and has about one shower a week. But they're just obsessed with each other. And I'm like, that's kind of how it should be, isn't it? You know, when you're 20.
Yeah, yeah, kind of filthy in the clean yeah. sense of the word. They were literally they're dirty and they're having dirty sex in dirty places. But not, I don't mean that in, you know, the sense I'm using the word dirty in. But look, there's a flip side yeah. to that as well, which is that we can romanticize the past, but there was, I suppose, a lot of shame around sex, pregnancy, or homosexuality, even mm-hmm. though it's not that long ago in the book, and that is a big theme in it as well, isn't it?
I know, it's funny to think of, like, it's weird to be of an age now. I'm 33 now, and, like, to be my early 20s is now long enough ago that it counts as being a time period in a separate part of history.
Get ready for it only gets worse. Yeah.
I know. The years keep coming and they don't stop coming. Yeah, I think there's something. I'm fascinated with what I, you know, I do this on my podcast, but what I like to call kind of diagnostic nostalgia, where it's one thing to look back on your youth and be like, ah, Jesus, weren't we all gorgeous and weren't we all idiots, but we had great pairs of legs on us, you know?
Yeah.
And there's quite another to quite kind of really sit and poke and think about, you know, the shame you felt, the things that you wouldn't own up to, the secrets you kept, all because of the kind of general ambience of shame that was being pumped into the soil. And even though this was 2009 or whatever, I do think we were still in a hangover of, like, an Ireland that had emerged out of that sort of culture of mass shame, but it hadn't grown into a new thing. So it was like a lot of that feeling was still hanging over, you know. The morning after pill was still very hard to get, obviously abortion's out of the question, you know, like I do think the knock-on effect of when people's lives was huge because of that. And really every character in this novel, and there's only about six of them, but they're all acting in response to that culture of shame in some way or another. It's what motivates what they do.
Yeah, yeah. And that's only, like, yeah, as you say, it's 12, 13 years ago.
Yeah.
Funny thing, though, for all the randiness, the main kind of love story then, right, is a platonic one between Rachel and her friend James, who is gay. But You do almost present it a love story. Like, they do fall in love a bit, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And, it, you know, it was very much inspired by, like, now the plot is utterly fictional. But in terms of the emotional time and place, like Cork at that moment in time, it's very autobiographical. So I was living with my best mate, Ryan Farrell, at the time, and we were living in this little house in Shandon Street. And I think up until that point, I had been someone who was very ready to be molded by whatever boyfriend I had. Do you know what I mean? It was okay. Very like, you know, I go out with someone for 5 or 6 weeks and whatever they were into, I was into as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had I had a lot of sort of vim, but I had no like real self-esteem or sense of self. And then me and Ryan met we were working in HMV in Patrick Street, and he was a Christmas temp and I was a staffer. And it was a bit like, I always describe it as being like, you know, in those old movies where you see, you know, a soldier say to his buddy, you know, I'm gonna marry that girl one day. It felt like I saw him across the room and I was like, oh, this is the person I've been waiting for. And
yeah,
it was like everything about who I am now, the kind of the pop culture obsession, the sort of like obsessiveness with Cher, like, you know, everything about me, can kind of be rooted back to that shop floor in HMV. And I really wanted to pay honor to that kind of friendship.
So I wonder, is that something that men now will identify with? So for women, sometimes is making a friend is like falling in love. Do you think that's more true for women and maybe gay men than it is for men? Are men as good at it?
We all know they're not, right? And I'm sure you have many dear friends who you're constantly, you know, seeing all the time. But I you know, have a partner, and we've been together for 10 years. And I remember a few years ago, he was in a real place where he was like, you know, all of his sort of school friends lived in awkward parts of the city, and he barely saw them, and they were starting to have children, and we don't have children yet. So there was that gap was slightly forming, and yeah, he had no people to fill that gap. And he was like confused as to how it went about. And there was a year and a half there where he was like, am I just not likable? Am I not friendly? Am I not whatever? But it was just, I think the idea of like asking another man out to dinner when you're a straight man, the way you would as a straight woman, is totally unfathomable. You know,
should we maybe do something together sometime? Like the idea of a guy saying that, like, we're getting on quite well here, would we do something? No, okay.
Totally, I know, but you'll be happy to hear now, he's in the last year and a half, he's become a total golf nut, and now he makes all his friends through golf when he has a golf.
Okay, so do you reckon that's the thing with men, like they do stuff with other men, and then in between the cracks of that, when they're not looking each other in the eye, the little conversations happen and the friendships grow, is it?
Exactly. I always think that this is why men love going on stag do's and women hate going on hen do's, because women sort of demand a level of friendship from each other kind of 24/7 that's quite nurturing and quite attentive,
yes,
whereas men don't have that. So when they go on stag do's, they finally get to stay up till 5 a.m. and talk about their feelings, whereas women kind of live in that emotional state, you know.
Yeah, to an extent. Or sometimes just men are more comfortable going go-karting half drunk with where they know 50% of the other guys there. Yeah,
and
listen, you've mentioned a few times your kind of pop culture thing, so you have this podcast, Sentimental Garbage, and I'm right in saying it's kind of about the joys of what we might see as lowbrow culture, is it?
Yeah. I started it out in a kind of a cynical business-like fashion, because I became an author in 2018, and you find really quickly that it's very hard to connect and find other authors unless you're at like literary festivals, in which case you're all on the job, so it's difficult. So I was like, I want to find a way to meet people, because I'm a very social person and writing is a very insular job. And I'm also fascinated by, you know, Marianne Keyes and Jilly Cooper and all this, like the books that I grew up on and the books that taught me how to plot books and how to do big plots, but never seem to get like the big essays or the big retrospectives. Now, I think that's changed actually in the last couple of years, but back then there was like no, you know, I wanted to read the 5,000 words about what Marianne Keyes' oeuvre was actually about, and there was nowhere. So I decided I would start this podcast that would circulate on women's fiction, and we did that for a while, and then like it almost felt like we were winning the argument, because like all the romance novels started becoming really popular in a very mainstream critical way. And so I started expanding it. So I started talking about TV shows and movies, and then I expanded
What kind of TV shows and movies then are unregarded classics?
the thing that we got that really got us over the edge was during lockdown, myself and my friend Dolly Alderton, who's a journalist and writer as well, we did this podcast together called Sentimental in the City, which was reviewing each season of Sex in the City for the great American novel it truly is. So we would treat it like it was East of Eden or something, and really go comb through the themes and the artistic movements. And it weirdly, it became very big during lockdown with quite a segment of the female population.
And so did it stand up to academic analysis from you and Dolly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I've got the extent of my academic sort of credentials is a BA from UCC. So I think it did. Yeah.
Listen, don't diss a BA from UCC. There's plenty of people doing fine in life with a BA from UCC.
Well, I know. Do you know what? I was on the Radio Times yesterday saying, you know, when I would move to London, I was made to feel very embarrassed about the fact that I had this kind of nothingy degree from a university that nobody in England had heard of. But the further I get into this career and the more I meet people with Oxford and Cambridge degrees and all that, I realize that, like, they got deeply into debt for a degree that, you know, I feel like it's serving me. My UCC degree is serving me just as well as any Cambridge or Oxford degree would have, you know?
Absolutely. An arts degree from UCC is just as useful as an arts degree from anywhere else. Yeah. Would we put it like that? So Claire,
exactly.
Speaking of which, I forgot to get your kind of story. So you're obviously, I'm guessing you're unfashionably from middle-class suburban Cork, which is... It's not a fashionable thing to be. We can both admit that. Rochestown,
and where?
Yeah, where Douglas, Rochestown, whereabouts?
Rochestown. Yeah.
There you go. You can micro sort people from Cork by nuances in the accent. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I thought I was taking a great fictional leap by making Rachel from Douglas while I'm from Rochestown.
And then how did you end, like, you're hugely successful in London, the novelising, but hugely successful journalist and everything else. How did that all happen?
Well, do you know, so the year that is depicted in the Rachel incident, the one where, you know, she's living with her friend in Chandon Street or whatever, there was a version of that ended when so I worked in HMV, all of my friends then went on, because they were about a year and a half older than me. They all emigrated after they graduated because of the recession. They all moved to Sydney or Toronto or whatever. And I was kind of left alone, and I had to move home because there was no one left to live with. And I was so jealous that everybody was on, like, Bondi Beach, you know, or whatever, that I started blogging to sort of show them that I was doing stuff too. Like, my life wasn't standing still back in Cork.
You go, girl.
From there, then I was asked to write for the now defunct Cork News, which was actually a great free paper that came out every Friday. And I had this, like, fabulous time where I would get to interview bands that were coming into Cork. And then I developed a kind of a little portfolio of clippings. And then I was like, sure, that's enough to move to London with and become a journalist. And then I moved to London and I quickly realized that nobody in London cares about anything that happens in Ireland. And I couldn't get a job at all. Like I couldn't get arrested in that town for about 3 years. And in the meantime, I just took a load of jobs. I had bar work. I worked in film sets for a while. I worked in recruitment, I worked in advertising, and the whole time I just kept this blogging thing up. And eventually I started working, you know, as a staffer on a women's website, and then my writing got noticed, I got an agent, and I started tipping away at a novel, and that became my first novel, Promising Young Women.
Okay, and you've done 3 teenage novels as well.
Yes.
Which are kind of supernatural themed.
They are supernatural, but they're also very much based in Cork. They're very much odes to Cork as well. They're a trilogy. I this is another middle-class discerner. I went to Skullborough in Cork.
Oh, my God. Okay, I have it all now.
You have the whole picture.
I could write your biography now, okay.
Oh, my God. And literally, Brendan, this is embarrassing, but you're good friends with one of my cousins, so let's, like...
Okay.
The Cork nepotism...
Listen, we're going to drive people mad now. Go on.
I went to this kind of all-girls school called Vera, which is a very strange Cork institution in that it's the only girls' private school, and it's also a falling-down Victorian house that's run by a now-deceased nun. But I was so fond of that time in my life, and I always felt like it was a kind of a spooky way to grow up and go to school.
So you've kind of Harry Potter'd School Vera in Cork, basically.
That is precisely what I have done.
Amazing.
Yes. Very well said. Yeah.
Okay. It's funny, the further you're, the more you're away from Cork, the clearer you're kind of seeing it or not seeing it, isn't it? Is life in London now, is that where your life and your set and your scene and all that is now? Yeah.
Totally. And I find it so weird because when I work, I'm totally here. My my husband to be, he's from Essex. We're very much set in London, you know. When I first started writing fiction, everything was English. Do you know what I mean? Like my first novel, the character was sort of vaguely English. I didn't even really give her a backstory because I sort of thought that like Irishness wasn't interesting, and also that I felt so disjointed and placeless, I guess. You know, I felt like I wasn't really a Londoner yet, and I wasn't really from Cork anymore, is how I felt at the time, because I felt so out of step with what everyone was doing. And now the older I get, the clearer Cork comes into focus. It's like, you know, when you get an eye test and you can see the red balloon, you know, it's like, see it totally clearly now, you know?
Yeah. So there's an element of kind of James Joyce. You're there in exile, seeing the home country clearly and writing randy novels about it all. By the way, Caroline O'Donoghue, I have something to tell you. A few texters are saying Ambrogue is still there. It may have closed down for a while, but it is open now. So it's important to make that clear. Yeah, it's apparently so.
I thought that they changed, that the ownership changed, and it's a new kind of
pub. Do you know what?
I mean,
we've got parochial enough here now without getting into the ownership of various pubs in Cork. I'm sure they'll be texting again. But I'd say Caroline, you get it. It's a craft beer pub now, I'm being told.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'll tell you what.
Oh my God.
There was no craft beer there in my day, and I suspect not in your day either. But listen,
City of Cork is just lit up by hearing this much about itself on the radio.
I know. Yeah, and the rest of the country is puking. So let's be careful. There's a fine line, I'm telling you, and I know it. I know it. They'll be
okay,
on now.
Okay, you know better than I would now.
But
yeah,
listen,
yeah,
just to annoy people a bit more. So you Harry Potter Cork. I gather there's going to be a kind of Sex in the City Cork style soon, because the Rachel incident, is it being made into TV or a movie?
Well, TV, that's the plan. It was actually picked up by Universal Studios and optioned by Elliot Page, who, you know, the star of Juno.
Amazing.
His production company have picked it up, and I've written the first episode. We got a showrunner attached, who's a very fancy showrunner, and then the writer strike in America happened, so it's all on pause for the minute. But it's all looking very.
But it is. It's real. It's actually probably going to happen. Like.
Well, I mean.
Yeah, I know.
I wouldn't dare. I wouldn't dare commit that to radio. Yeah. Yeah.
You're not spending the money yet. Is it going to be shot in Cork? If it is.
Yeah, I mean, that was very much the condition of the...
Listen, lads, the excitement will be off the charts. There's a texter here. I'm now wallowing in my memory of youth and Cork college days. Kerry Man in Gillaby Street, off to Sissy Young's on Tuesday night for trad session. £4 left to eat after. In Lennox's, rest of the week was Gorby's members card and €1 out-of-date Carlsberg or TNT. What a life. There was never any out-of-date Carlsberg in Cork. So listen, you mentioned you're getting married soon to an Essex boy. Are you getting married in Essex or will you come back?
No, we're getting married in Kerry, actually. My parents have a little caravan in Kerry, and we go down there. Every time I bring him to Ireland, I bring him to Kerry. So he has a Kerry shirt and a Cork shirt, and he's very proud of both of them.
Okay.
And we're getting married at the end of the summer, and excited about it.
She's getting married in a caravan in Kerry. Good man.
I mean, no, sorry. No, we're not getting married in the caravan.
I know. I get you. Married in a church, and the afters will be in the caravan. I understand.
That'll be it. Yeah.
Listen, Caroline, the Rachel incident is fantastic. And I think anyone looking for like a beach read or whatever, kind of an elevated beach read, I would call it. But I really enjoyed it. I hope it didn't scandalize your parents too much. I was warned beforehand that your parents are listening in Cork, which put manners on both of us.
I have to keep pointing out to my mom, like, he brought up the sex stuff, mom.
Yeah, you were just being polite. Okay, listen, Caroline, thanks. The Rachel Incident is published by Virago. It's in the shops now. Caroline Donoghue, thank you very much.
That was fabulous, Brendan. Thank you.
Email brendan@rte.ie.